Joshua Cantor, Executor against Commissioner.
May it please the Court, Richard Fildes for the Cantor Estate. As you know, this case was tried 15 years ago. It's gone on this long primarily for two reasons. First, the tax court's deception of this court and the other courts of appeals and the taxpayers, which was exposed by Judge Cudahy's dissent in the United States Supreme Court's opinion confirming that dissent.
We don't need to use inflammatory language, Mr. Pildes. The tax court was keeping those things confidential, as we know, and the Supreme Court then ruled it couldn't do so. But I
agree, Your Honor, but
it thought it was like law clerk memos, which all of us receive, and we don't put there in the front of our opinion. So,
well, Your Honor, we don't need to get deeply into this, but last time the opinion of this court said we take the tax court at its word. We assume this is true. And in fact, there were three separate motions we filed to get this report. And if you look at the tax court's responses to those motions, I do think it's fair to say and to express our frustration that those answers were quite deceptive. But I agree it's not relevant here.
One of the questions that concerns me or that I'd like to hear your thoughts on in this case has to do with the relation between this case and the two decisions, one in the Fifth and one in the 11th Circuit, because the commissioner argues that Mr. Cantor was really just in a different situation. And so even if Ballard and Lyle had their cases come out as they did, we really have different conduct, different activities, and thus possibly a different tax. Well, the commission argues a different tax result. So could you address that?
Sure, Your Honor. First of all, the 11th and the 5th Circuits found that Judge Haynes vastly exceeded his limited authority on remand, and we believe that exactly the same reasons that those courts identified to justify that conclusion applied to his findings with respect to Cantor and the Cantor-specific issues. Remember, the 11th Circuit used language like Judge Haynes' opinion involved leaps of logic, speculative inferences, that there were no concrete facts he marshaled to justify overturning the trial judge. And just as he did that with respect to all of the issues involving these prudential transactions that the 11th Circuit went through in great detail and that the trial judge made detailed findings on, he committed the same kinds of errors in the Cantor-specific issues. Now, with respect to Cantor and the transactions with the five, if you're asking about that in particular.
I really am. I mean, obviously the B. Rich trusts and all those things really are just Cantor, but what about the ones that overlap?
Yes. So, of course, the government's theory was that the three individuals involved, Ballard, Cantor, and Lyle, conspired to create these schemes involving alleged kickback payments and to not report these as personal income, even though every dollar of income was reported by the various entities that received the income. Once the 11th and the 5th Circuit...
It's fishy. I mean, obviously, they've been litigating this forever, that Mr. Cantor didn't have any income for 11 years.
Yes, and I assume that has something to do with the government's aggressive pursuit of Cantor. And, of course, Cantor was a very well-known tax attorney. He was a major antagonist of the tax court. He had represented major estates in tax planning. But keep in mind a number of things about that fact. First, he was audited in every one of these years. Secondly, although it's not in the record, he did have a lot of tax-deferred income, which at his death was paid. We wrote a check almost $3 million for personal income taxes at that time. Third, he did report income, but he reported deductions from various kinds of investments, tax-advantaged investments, particularly in the real estate area. So that offset the income that he reported. And in addition, as the record indicates, he was primarily an investor by the time of these transactions. He was not earning much of a salary as a partner in the law firm. In fact, the firm had dissolved. He was of counsel. So that's the larger context in which that fact needs to be understood. Now, once the courts of appeals have found that the trial judge was not clearly erroneous in his findings with respect to these transactions, in which 90% of the income supposedly went to Ballard and Lyle, I don't see any basis for somehow concluding that there was a fraudulent scheme involving these individuals, and that Cantor somehow is liable for 10% of that, even though 90% of it has nothing to do with the fraud. The government has an alternative.
Is your position that they're just so interlinked that a rational person couldn't possibly come to a different conclusion for Mr. Cantor?
I think that's correct, at least with respect to the 10% theory. That's the principal theory the government has been arguing all along with respect to Cantor, that once the courts of appeals have found that these were investment opportunities through these entities, these were legitimate investment opportunities, that there was not income earned by any of the taxpayers, that there was no scheme to distribute that income down through this supposed flow of funds argument, I do think there's no rational way, without directly rejecting the trial judge and the Fifth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit, to conclude that somehow the minor participant, at least supposedly the 10% income earner, was involved in this kind of scheme, and the other two have already been, you know, completely vindicated with respect to the scheme.
Well, he plays a different role, I guess. He's the lawyer getting this prudential, influencing prudential. One of the other broad arguments that the government makes is that we shouldn't give the kind of deference that you're arguing for to Judge Kuvion's decision because he actually was asking the wrong questions. I'll just summarize it that way. He was failing to recognize the real theory that the commissioner was presenting, and he failed to see that the fraud theory was different from the payment of tax theory, that whole package of arguments.
Right.
Obviously, we wouldn't defer to findings of fact if they're based on the wrong questions.
And that's precisely what the government argued to the Fifth Circuit and to the Eleventh Circuit, and both courts expressly rejected exactly that argument. They said that the trial judge was correct, that there had not been income earned to the individuals. Once there was no income earned, the whole flow of funds argument doesn't have any basis for getting started. And in addition, the 11th Circuit went on to hold that nonetheless.
I'd like to follow up on this flow of funds argument that the government really is relying on rather heavily here, it seems to me. And I don't fully understand either why the other circuits rejected this as being relevant. I don't know on what basis. You could say they rejected part of it. They didn't see any reason for following the flow of funds from corporation to corporation if there was no showing that there was off kilter to start with, or did they find it was irrelevant throughout? I can't quite identify what their reasoning is.
Your Honor, they rejected.
And this is all based, as I understand it, on Cantor's testimony. And I don't know how much testimony he gave. I think the only thing that's probative, really, is the statement that there is this split, which I guess he made. And the money did, in fact, follow that split. And his reason for doing it that way is that he says he wanted to diversify the investments of these various companies, which I'm not sure that would require a 45-45-10% split. So that's not the complete answer, it doesn't seem to me. So could you explain why you think this situation is probative, and these other circuits apparently said it wasn't.
Sure, Judge Cudahy. And there are a number of different questions contained in your question, and so let me try to take them on one by one. First, the other courts and the trial judge found on the merits that this was an asset allocation scheme. So they said that the claim of the government was irrelevant because no income had been earned, but they did go on to address the claim on the merits. And as I said, both the trial judge and the courts of appeals rejected it on the merits, number one. Number two, it's not at all Cantor's testimony alone that the trial judge relied on to make findings here. There was testimony from Weisskull, a trustee, testimony from Ballard, testimony from Lyle, testimony from trustees. There were many witnesses who testified at this five-week trial. And the trial judge's findings of credibility about these various witnesses are all interlocking.
They all testify to this particular split, this 45-45 split.
Your Honor, we actually don't agree that the 45-45-10 split existed or was established. This is something that has been assumed.
Well,
it wasn't pursued.
What's the basis of the testimony for talking about it? That's what I don't understand.
Well, there was money that flowed down from IRA to these three entities. Yeah. And when IRA had free cash, the money went 45-45-10 from IRA.
But remember, fact went that way, but you're saying that's the way it went in fact.
Some of these transactions were with other entities, and money from that entity, THC, did not flow down to these three entities.
I understand all that. Are you just saying that this is in fact the way the money went, or are you saying this, that somebody said that was our intention was to split the money that way?
What I'm saying is that the money from the transactions with the five did not flow down in this 45-45-10 arrangement. This was not fully developed at trial. The money wasn't fully traced. What did go down in this 45-45-10 arrangement was the free cash that this one entity, IRA, had. But what I want to also...
And so just to finish off, so an inference was drawn that that was the allocation agreement?
An assumption developed at some point that... went beyond the facts of IRA's free cash itself. The testimony in the record is that Cantor went to the trustee of IRA and suggested actually a 50-50 split of this free cash to TMT and Carlco, and it was the trustee, Mr. Freeman, who suggested maybe we should do it 45-45-10, 10% to the BWK. And that testimony is in the record and not disputed. But it was only the free cash that IRA had that flowed down in this way. There was a lot of other money coming in, which the government raises issues about, and just assumes somehow came down in that 45-45-10 arrangement.
Did Cantor ever make a statement that this is the way we wanted the money split?
This is the way they wanted the free cash that was in IRA.
Did he say that? Did he testify to that fact?
I would have to check the record. I believe that this is correct.
Figure out what is probative about this, about the fact that the money followed these paths.
It's only probative of what the trial judge found and the courts of appeals found, was that this was a way of allocating for investment purposes the cash that was in IRA that was going to be managed for real estate, for bonds.
I don't go from that fact to the fact that it was split in this particular, these particular proportions. I mean, what are the proportions got to do with the diversification objective? You can split them in a lot of other ways.
That's correct. But the courts of appeals and the trial judge have, of course, already rejected the fact that the 90% that went 45 to TNT, TMT, and 45 to Carlco were anything other than an asset management scheme. There was no income that was improperly earned.
I'm trying to figure out what the government, I guess, will tell me what all this proves when they're up there.
We've certainly been puzzled in trying to understand various aspects of the government's theory. I confess to some puzzlement myself. I'd like to turn, if the court permits, to the two Cantor-specific issues that were not addressed already by the 11th and 5th Circuit. The first, the minor issue, and I want to address it first because it's small and easy to address, which is the Century Industries issue. And I wanted to just speak to the merits of that issue. The trial judge specifically found that all the partners of Century were to be respected. Judge Haynes decided to overturn yet again this finding of fact. He concluded that the partnership structure should be ignored. And here are some of the facts the government has to overcome to justify Judge Haynes rejecting the trial judge's findings. First of all, Century did exactly what it was designed to do. It did make calls on capital to its partners for contributions. It did make investments starting in 1987. The partners were obligated by the partnership agreement to provide capital when there were calls on capital. 98% of the original capital for Century came from the various partners. Weisskill testified at great length about Century Industries and its function. And actually, it's fascinating to read the transcript of that testimony, because the trial judge asked many, many questions of Weisskull and concluded that Century Industries was what it was represented to be, an investment vehicle. What the government does here to rebut this is basically two things. The first is the government quotes from the trial judge, from the transcript, when he asked a question of Weisskull, as if that question suggested he disbelieved Weisskull. Now, as our reply brief points out, if you look at the full exchange, it's very clear that the trial judge became satisfied by Weisskull's response. But it's also a very strange kind of argument for the government to make, because obviously the trial judge at the end of the day did believe Weisskull and did believe that these partnerships, that this was a legitimate business purpose partnership. And the second thing Judge Haynes does is to take some obscure documents or two letters, which are themselves ambiguous, which were before the trial judge, and to infer from these letters that Century wasn't actually a legitimate partnership and the partnership structure could be ignored. Those letters are, as I say, relatively ambiguous. They're consistent, in fact, with Century as an investment vehicle. This was all before the trial judge, and as I say, he asked extensive questions about all of this and made his findings of fact.
One of the things the government argues, and again, this is sort of a broad point about all of this, is, you know, cites from Anderson against Bessemer City, and I think it's trying to say that you are making these findings of fact of the trial judge impossible to attack. And in fact, the clearly erroneous standard does permit somebody in the position of Judge Haynes, let's assume, as you say, that Judge Haynes essentially has to give clearly erroneous deferential review to the trial judge's findings of fact. But nonetheless, a trial judge can have a definite and firm conviction that they're wrong.
How
do we review that definite and firm conviction of Judge Haynes? Do we just jump over him and go back to the trial judge, or do we look at him?
Well, first of all, the Supreme Court, in its opinion in this case, said the findings of the trial judge would be vital. That's the court's word in a case like this. And the court, in fact, quoted Judge Cudahy's dissent, in which he said there would be no single item of more significance in a case like this than the findings of the trial judge. Number one. Number two, this court in general and the majority of courts of appeals have taken the view that in this review of review situation, the correct thing to do is to focus on the original finder of fact and apply the clearly erroneous standard to those findings. Now, I don't think it really matters a great deal if instead one says technically you are reviewing the opinion of the tax court in order to determine whether Judge Haynes was correct in deciding that the trial judge's findings were manifestly unreasonable. And I think we basically are in agreement that obviously these findings have to have significant weight. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court said. That's what the tax court's own rules say. The courts of appeals in this case, through their mandates, ordered the tax court not to overturn those findings unless they were manifestly unreasonable. The government conceded before Judge Haynes that the manifestly unreasonable standard was the correct standard to apply to all three taxpayers, and that's what Judge Haynes purported to apply. So yes, there's no question that leaves some room for the reviewing judge, but it's a very limited mandate, as the 11th Circuit said. Beyond that, the 11th Circuit and the 5th Circuit recognized that Judge Haynes had gone way beyond whatever limited role might be proper for him. As they said, he, by his own terms, made inferences. He had no concrete facts to justify these results. He made leaps of logic. So there's no disagreement that there is some latitude there, and there's no disagreement with the courts of appeals in the 5th or 11th Circuit on our part that what he did was vastly exceed that limited authority. And what he did here, if we can focus on the BRT trusts to make this a little more concrete, is once again he relied on obscure documents that were not even the focus of trial, and then started building sort of inference upon inference from those documents to justify overturning the findings of fact of the trial judge.
Now, these are the voluminous documents, right, that the government refers to brief.
These are the obscure documents that he relies on with respect to the BRTs. This is one of the more complicated cases I've ever had to try to make sense of. The trial judge spent 4 years with this, by the way, before he produced his 300-page report. The obscure documents they rely on here are these Schedule K-1 forms, which they say, which Judge Haynes said shows that Cantor did not renounce his power of appointment under those trusts. Now, first of all, the trial judge specifically found that Cantor had renounced his power of appointment. Secondly, there were three separate formal legal documents that he filed, signed, renouncing his power of appointment. Third, both Cantor and Weissel testified that he had renounced his power of appointment. And as I say, the trial judge found all of this convincing and reached that conclusion. The IRS did not introduce any evidence at trial to challenge this set of findings about Cantor renouncing, or these arguments about Cantor renouncing his power of appointment. What happened is, for the first time on post-trial briefs, the government pointed to these K-1 documents that no one had focused on at trial and said, aha, this is evidence that Cantor actually did not renounce his power of appointment. Now, number one, the trial judge ruled that arguments raised for the first time on post-trial briefing were not properly before him, and that alone would be enough reason to uphold this finding. But number two, on the merits, this claim involves an extraordinary amount of speculation. The claim is that these 60 new trusts were appointed as beneficiaries, of which there's no evidence, and that Cantor must have been the person who appointed them if they were appointed. And Judge Haynes says this in one sentence, okay? And we dispute every step in those inferences, even if this issue is properly before this court and not waived by the government.
But before you get to that issue, the issue is whether Cantor funded these trusts or not, right?
Well, he has to have been both a grantor.
The government's position is that he put the money into them, right? And I gather the response to that is that they achieved extraordinary investment success mainly because of the investment in Cablevision, is that?
That's correct, Your Honor. And remember that Cantor has to be both a grantor and to have done something else to be treated as...
Yeah, I understand.
Okay.
You've got to have both.
Okay. And so if he has not... if he relinquished the power of appointment, this issue is irrelevant. But on the question about whether he was a grantor... the trial judge relied on two basic things. I mean, not the trial judge, Judge Haynes, to overturn the trial judge, who again made specific findings on this issue. The Cantor was not the grantor. First, the prudential scheme. The trial judge said, well, all that earned income that I've decided was earned income funded the BRTs. Now, that falls at the same time the rest of that whole story falls. The second thing is that
Haynes said this was investment success that's never been achieved by anybody else or something.
Well, that's partly because I think he misunderstood the facts here. Everyone recognizes that the trusts put $18,000 into the Cablevision investment through this entity OBA in the early 1970s when cable was very early on, very speculative, very risky, but had very significant payoffs. So we know where those millions of dollars came from, and there's no mystery or no dispute about that. The second thing that Judge Haynes relied on to say that Cantor was the grantor is the view that further investments in Cablevision by this entity were actually fees for services to Cantor instead of legitimate investments by OBA. Again, the trial judge specifically rejected that. The Statlin case in the courts in Illinois rejected that, or at least can be read to reject that. OBA was on call to make further capital investments if necessary. That's what the trial judge found. It was a legitimate entity making those investments, and we don't think there's anything more to that issue. We think that Judge Haynes did exactly the same thing with respect to that issue that he did with respect to the prudential transactions, which is basically do de novo findings of fact, because he thought the record should be read differently than the way the trial judge read it. And that he relied on inferences and nothing concrete enough to meet his standard of limited review.
Okay, so, you're about to run out of time if you don't want rebuttal.
I'll save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
30 seconds. All right, Ms. Oppenheimer.
Burton Cantor was a very prominent attorney who had a number of business acquaintances who wanted business opportunities. As this court noted in a prior opinion, he hobnobbed with the Pritzkers, who owned Hyatt Corporation. He hobnobbed with film producers. He participated in very successful business ventures, including One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He also knew Hugh Hefner and solicited him as an investor for the Cablevision, the cable TV project. Yet when you look at his income tax returns, for every year in issue, he reported negative adjusted gross income. In some years, the negative adjusted gross income exceeds $1 million.
Well, that's obviously why the commissioner brought this proceeding in the first place. But the issue before us is, did he really prove anything?
I
think that's what we're interested in.
It's our position.
I think it's interesting that the first time around, the tax court opinion said the court agrees with and adopts the opinion of the special trial judge, which is set forth below. And now you're here to tell us why we shouldn't accept the opinion of the trial judge, which makes your task somewhat difficult, I think.
Actually, if you accept some of the findings of the special trial judge, they actually support our position in this case.
But not at the end of the day. I mean, I guess your opening makes it sound like this is a brand new case, and you know, and unfortunately for all of us, it really isn't a brand new case. It's been around for a long time, and I'm concerned about what seems to me real tension in the government's brief between the standard of review that the Supreme Court said needs to apply vis-a-vis these special trial court findings and the standard that you're arguing for here, and the fact that when all is said and done, Judge Kuvion's opinion rules in favor of Mr. Cantor. There are all manner of ways that you can come up with an adjusted gross income of zero. It's not like he was saying he wasn't getting anything. It's adjusted gross income.
Your Honor, it's our position that whatever standard of review is applied in this case, we win, though it is our position that it is Judge Haynes's opinion that is reviewed for clear error and not the special trial judges. But even
that's
if
not quite what the Supreme Court said. The Supreme Court couldn't have been clearer that we need to go back to the opinion of the person who actually looked at the witnesses and made credibility determinations. So I think that's
well, this
we need to approach it.
All right. If you approach it that way, the special trial judge found the testimony of the five to be credible. And every member of the five who got up and testified said it was Burton Cantor's influence that we wanted, and that was what we were paying for. For example, Hewlett got up and said, currently what I manage is these mom-and-pop roadside hotels, and I want to manage larger hotels, and so it was Cantor's influence that I wanted. This is in the Hewlett transaction. He got up and said, It's Cantor's influence that I wanted.
Even though he says that, though, I mean, this is a tax case. And so the question is, were there kickbacks? Were there failures to pay taxes that were due? You know, people enter into legitimate business deals every day with somebody who they think can help them in their business. And as long as they report the income appropriately and pay their taxes, there's nothing illegal about that.
That's correct, but we are not saying that the kickback or commission or whatever you want to call it, we are not saying it's illegal. What we're saying is that he didn't report the income.
So that's different from having anybody of the five get up there and say we wanted the influence. Maybe that is in the record, but the trial judge finds at the end that there's no tax problem, just to summarize a gigantically long opinion.
Well, essentially what the special trial judge said is all of the witnesses got up and said, We weren't paying for Ballard's and Lyle's influence. We were paying for Cantor's influence. So that may get Ballard and Lyle off. That's essentially what the Fifth and Eleventh Circuit said, but it doesn't get Cantor off. And the government was quite clear in the tax court. As far as the scheme with the five was concerned, we had three different theories. There was the prudential scheme in which all three were involved, the traveler's scheme in which only Lyle and Lyle and Cantor were involved, and the Cantor transactions in which only Cantor was involved. For example, there were a number of take the Fry transaction. Cantor had separate side deals with Fry before Lyle and Ballard ever got involved. Fry went to see Cantor for tax advice. In the process, Cantor told him, I can add value to your projects, but I want to be on the same basis as everyone else. I don't want anyone to have an edge. So Fry entered an agreement just with Cantor, sharing developers' fees and management fees for a couple of projects, specifically there were two projects specifically, 535 North Michigan and the Lakewood project.
Now, but could I just say, I think there are two levels at which we need to look at the Supreme Court decision, but really the Fifth and the Eleventh Circuit decision. One level is how do we approach this from a procedural point of view? And the other is, they actually make the argument for estoppel with respect to certain facts. We understand about estoppel in the law. And I'm certainly willing to believe that there are plenty of Cantor-specific issues that just need to be decided. But the problem I have with your position is if we're going to take the right procedural approach, then we go back to the special trial judge's opinion, and he rules against you. It's not to say that had he ruled in favor of you, that might have been a supportable decision as well, but he's evaluated the evidence and ruled against you at the bottom line for Cantor.
Well, I have a couple of responses for that. First of all, the court was primarily looking at it in the context of Lyle, and in the context of Ballard, and the special trial judge relied on the testimony of the witnesses who said it wasn't Ballard we wanted, it was Cantor. So that
now,
may
this business of reading Lyle and Ballard out of the case, which seems to be what you're doing now, how is that consistent with giving them 45 of percent of the proceeds and Cantor only gets 10? I mean, I don't see how you can say that Cantor was all by himself in these deals.
Well, that's our alternative position.
I know, but they're pretty contradictory, it seems to me.
In further response to Judge Wood's question, we feel that the 11th Circuit made the same mistake as the special trial judge and basically ignored the flow of the money argument. Our argument about the flow of the money was the centerpiece of the government's case. So basically both the special trial judge and also the 11th Circuit say, well, once we believe the witnesses, we don't have to look at the documentary evidence. But
I don't think that's quite – I mean, Mr. Pildes was arguing that if there's no illegitimate money or if there's no money to begin with, there's nothing to flow, if I understand his argument correctly. No kickbacks, all the money was being accounted for properly, so there isn't anything to flow through.
Well,
that's the same as ignoring your argument. It's trying to say, at what point does it become irrelevant?
Well, it's not irrelevant. One way of determining whether there was, the documentary evidence was the centerpiece of the government's case, and it's our position the flow of the money is critical in determining whether there was, in fact, a kickback scheme or commission scheme
Could
or whatever
you
call it.
Could you explain that? Why is it? What does it prove?
Well, it
what proves what in that regard?
Well, when you look at the money, every single one of these first of all, money was accumulated in IRA until 1984. Then Cantor announces that there's going to be 45-45-10 split. And by the way,
when you say Cantor announces, Judge Cuddy was asking before, where in the record have Cantor actually saying
the record?
That?
The record references I have are our transcript references page 3690 to 3692. I believe that was Cantor's testimony. And the testimony was it was agreed to split this money 45-45-10, and the split, you know, was constant. Now, Pildes did not try the case. Maybe he just isn't aware of it. But really the only issue has been in the, that's been in the case is whether this was there has never really been an issue until Pildes argued this case about whether this was a 45-45-10 split. The controversy has always been, was this an allocation, an asset allocation to diversify investments as Cantor testified it, as Cantor claimed, or was this simply a split of kickbacks as the commissioner claimed? So up until now, there was never any dispute that that was how the money was split. And there was direct testimony that this, you know, that this split remained constant over the years. That's on page, transcript testimony, page 3691. And the exhibits cited in my brief at page 53, page 54, you know, show that. So the money from the Prudential transactions was split 45-45-10. There was...
If you need some water, you can take a minute and get some.
Thank you. The payments from the buyback of the PMS stock were split 45-45-10. As far as the Hyatt transaction, a partnership was formed, the KWJ company, and each of the three entities, TMT, Carl Cohen, BMBWK, which stands for Cantor's initials, also they had a 45-45-10 split. So there simply is no dispute that that is how the money was split. And it's our position.
And it's your contention that Cantor specifically endorsed that those proportions of split.
He not only endorsed it, he was the one that announced it.
Okay.
The only question that has ever been raised is what the purpose of the split was. Was it, you know, to diversify IRA's investments, as Cantor claimed, or was it simply a method of giving the men the 45-45-10 split that they had?
Does Kavilian's opinion express a specific view of why the split was made as it was?
As my recollection, he did not. No, he did. He did agree with. I believe he agreed with Cantor. You know, he accepted Cantor's testimony. And
so why isn't that a finding of fact?
Because in the Anderson versus City of Bessemer tells us that even a finding based on credibility can overturn if it's inherently implausible.
Well, so you're saying, yes, it is a finding of fact, but there might be some way of showing that it's clearly erroneous. But
that's
why
correct.
Is that? Why is it inherently implausible that it's asset allocation for diversification versus a kickback?
Well, for
just kind of equal explanations, and it's going to be one or the other.
Well, for one thing, he testified that that Ballard was given TMT to manage because of his expertise in real estate, and yet during the years in question, Ballard didn't put the money in TMT in real estate. He invested it very heavily in municipal bonds. So that's the way he invested it is inconsistent with Cantor's testimony as to the supposed purpose of the split. Furthermore,
I can imagine arguing that to a trier of fact on a credibility point, but why is the trier of fact compelled to accept that argument as indicating lack of credibility?
Well, in further support, if they were...
Now, is a trier, so you agree, you're not compelled to take the one thing that you just mentioned and say, oh, well, you know, you thought it was going to be for real estate management, but instead you bought municipal bonds, ergo you're lying.
I wouldn't use the word compulsion, but I would say it's inherently implausible in language, you know, of Anderson versus City of Bessemer. And then let's look at the third corporation, BWK. There's no specific, you know, plan as to what was BWK going to invest in. There's nowhere in the record that it tells us. So it was basically, you know, just a post hoc rationalization of what was really done, which was to give these men, you know, the split, the 45-45-10, you know, 45-45, because Ballard and Lyle really controlled the purse strings of enabling Cantor's friends to get business, and then 10% because Cantor knew the businessman and he concealed this income through all these entities.
No, I mean, I guess my problem, I'm the government doesn't argue for such a searching review of findings of fact made by an original finder of fact in many other instances. And I have never seen anything in the Supreme Court's decisions to suggest that when it's a tax case, we're to do something closer to de novo review, and when it's a civil claim, then it's more deferential, et cetera, et cetera. There is a very deferential standard of review under clearly erroneous. The court seems to validate that in the Ballard case itself, Justice Ginsburg's opinion. And you've pretty much conceded that we would have to issue an opinion conflicting with the Fifth and Eleventh Circuits in order to rule for you on this.
Well, I don't really – that's one of – again, our position is that Cantor was differently situated than the other two. For example, Judge Haynes finds that he received income in a total of $3.25 million in transactions in which Ballard was not involved at all. These are his separate side deals with Frey. For example, in the Ulich transaction, the holding company owned either 21% or 23% was their share of the Essex partnership. Now, Ballard and Lyle didn't get any of that money. That was all went to Cantor. So you have three transactions, the Essex transaction, and then Cantor's separate side deals with Fry, in which Ballard and Lyle were never involved.
So we defer to Judge Kuvion's feelings if Ballard or Lyle is involved in the transaction, and we second-guess them if Cantor's there?
Well, no.
Our
position is that Cantor is differently situated from Ballard and Lyle for two reasons. Number one, he had these separate side deals with these men, in which the others weren't involved.
And what did the special trial judge say about those separate side deals?
As I remember, he didn't say anything. He focused really on the Prudential transactions. He never really discussed the deals involving Fry, Cantor's participation as a limited partner, Cantor's participation in the Michigan Avenue and Lakewood projects, the holding company's agreement with BJF, in which the holding company received certain fees for condominium conversions in which the Prudential was not involved. So Ballard and Lyle, they were just looking to decide their individual cases, and each one of those courts said, well, it may well be that Cantor earned all the money. The 11th Circuit says that directly. The 11th Circuit says Keynes is always pointing to Cantor, and it may well be that Cantor earned the money. But the same is not true of Ballard. So I think one can simply look at what, you know, the 11th Circuit says in Ballard and say...
Well, aren't they saying, well, Cantor's not our problem.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
We won't comment on him.
But the, I mean,
somebody else made, maybe.
The evidence shows that all the witnesses got up and said it's Cantor's influence we wanted. The witnesses signed
contracts. I have the impression, that, which may be entirely wrong, that Cantor was not very vigorously cross-examined in this trial. Is that correct?
I don't remember, Your Honor.
One reason I say that is because this business about the flow of funds has now become a major issue, I think, in the case. But I don't think there's a whole lot in the trial that's followed up on that circumstance.
Well,
I mean, you say that Cantor said there was a 45-45 split, which I believe he said, but I don't know whether anybody cross-examined him as to why that was the case or why the investment rationale was wrong or these other things.
Well, he did. Those questions were asked of him, and he did say, you know, it was. He did say that these three men, you know, didn't want any oversight. And so Cantor was cross-examined on that subject, and there were two different attorneys that, you know, could have done so. Lyle and Ballard were separately represented. So I think that maybe I should have turned my attention to the other two transactions in this case, the Be Rich Trust and the Century Industries. Appellants do not seriously contend that Cantor did not fund the Be Rich Trust. Their whole focus is on the power of disposition. Cantor had a limited power of appointment. So it's our position, the record is abundantly clear, that Cantor did fund the Be Rich Trust. There's no way that the $2,500 that his mother supposedly funded the trust could have grown to the millions of dollars it was worth in the years of issue.
And is that documented? I mean, because it seems to me one could trace that. I mean, they say, well, it was just some really good investments. Sometimes people, you know, invest in the right thing. Everybody talks about, gee, if I'd had 2 shares of Microsoft or something, maybe Cablevision was like that.
Well, Cablevision resulted. That's Cablevision was only one of the investment that the Be Rich Trust had. It also owned IRA stock. It also owned the holding company stock. It had an 18% interest in Oyster Bay Associates, for which it paid $18,000. So, putting aside the success of Cablevision, how on earth did the Be Rich Trust ever get the $18,000 if Cantor didn't fund it with his income?
But who do you think has the burden of proof on that? You're just assuming.
Taxpayer does, because a burden of in the notice of deficiency is presumed correct, and the taxpayer bears the burden of proving it incorrect. So what you basically have is appellant getting up and making a lot of speculation, saying, well, Weiskel could have, you know, appointed, you know, these 60 JSK trusts as beneficiaries. Well, they have the burden of proof. They're just getting up and speculating. Speculation is not proof. So if they can't get up, and what we have is documentary evidence that, you know, tax returns that they submitted, which are an admission against their evidence, that shows that there are these 60 trusts that are beneficiaries of the 25 Be Rich Trusts. So now they get up and tell you, oh, well, those are just documents. But documents are evidence, just the way witness testimony is evidence. So what we have throughout this case is a taxpayer that is telling this court to ignore documents because they're not witnesses.
Well, not quite. I mean, what they're saying is all of this was before the special trial court, who was weighing both testimony and documents and came up with a certain conclusion. And you're saying, no, we should take another look at the documents and contradict that conclusion.
Well, I would say that the special trial judge's report is deficient in a number of respects, and it's no wonder that Judge Haynes supplemented the opinion. He did adopt many of Judge Haynes' opinion. He supplemented them in certain respects, and he disagreed with them in certain respects. I think the evidence is abundant that Cantor funded the Be Rich Trust with his own earnings, and it's no answer to say, as the appellant does, that these entities pay tax on the income. They paid less tax than if Cantor was, if this money was all reported to Cantor, because the Beeridge trusts were 25 trusts. Each of them had a separate tax return. So what he achieves by assigning it to the Beeridge trust is splitting the income among 25 different entities. These entities are all the natural objects of his bounty, and he also avoids the gift tax, which he would otherwise have to pay if he reported it in his own income and then made them gifts of millions of dollars.
How are these trusts treated for estate tax purposes?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
Cantor, I assume, had an estate. And
he does have an estate. I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. It's our position that Judge Haynes got it right and that Judge Haynes' decision should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Oppenheimer. Your time is almost over, Mr. Pillis, but I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to clarify a couple of confusions. First, the trial judge did expressly find that none of the money from the transactions with the five were earned income to Cantor, Ballard, or Lyle. That's at page 84 of the trial judge's opinion. So that's a finding of fact that's established. Secondly, all of our discussion of the flow of funds doesn't really matter at the end of the day, because whether these were good ways of investing or not, they're only relevant if these were pocketbooks for the three individuals involved. If they were taking the money from these funds, the 11th, 5th Circuit, and the trial judge already found that the answer was no to that, that these were legitimate asset allocation schemes. Third and lastly, of course these entities were seeking the influence of Cantor as an experienced, well-known investor, someone who could bring other people to the table. It's like trying to have Donald Trump in your deals. Through his entities, Cantor invested in these entities, and it's perfectly understandable why people would want that as a signal of the credibility of the investment and the desirability of the investment. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
All right. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.